Good morning, Portland, Maine, Southern Maine, all over the world. If you're listening on the internet, this is Steve-O. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk, News Talk, WLOB, 1310 a.m. It's October 3rd. You know what that means, Deb?
What's it mean?
What does that mean? Later today, I am flying to China.
Oh, you're leaving the country. That's right.
Not only leaving the country, I think it's almost exactly the other side of the world.
I think you're right.
It is, I leave, this will air on Saturday. I leave tonight just after midnight. I go from Boston to Hong Kong.
Wow.
Then I fly down to Singapore. Then I go back to Hong Kong. Then I go to Macau. And then I go to a place called Shenzhen, which is a tech city.
Wow.
We have made plans with Sully for me to call in next week.
Yes, indeed.
Looking forward to broadcasting from China.
Exactly.
You bet. So we have a great show. In just a couple minutes, we have an interview I recorded yesterday with Mark Vinoy. He is the chairman of the Maine Public Utilities Commission. But what do we have on this day? In 1995, wow.
20 years ago
on this day, O.J. Simpson was acquitted. Do you remember that whole trial?
I certainly do.
That was captivating. For some reason, at that period in my life, I had a lot of free time. And I remember just watching the whole trial on television.
Yeah.
And you want to hear a funny byproduct of that?
Yes.
A couple of years ago, 3 years ago, my receptionist out here called back to my office and said, Steve, there's a gentleman named F. Lee Bailey waiting for you in the lobby. And I'm like, what? And we became friends. Mr. F. Lee Bailey moved here.
Yeah.
And he came in to say hi, and we went out and had lunch, and since then we've stayed in touch. And
that's great.
And yeah, so I mean, he and I disagree a little bit on the O.J. Simpson situation, but
yeah.
That's okay. Chubby Checker, this
Thank
is Chubby
you.
Checker. He turned 74. Wow. Yeah, I wish the audience could see you dancing in the studio. It's funny how you almost hear this song. You can't help it but dance, right?
No, you can't. You have to move.
No, you can't. So it's his birthday. Gwen Stefani turns 46. Roy, who's known as, one half of Siegfried and Roy, he turns 71.
Yep.
So let's get on with this interview and make sure that when I call next week that you take my call. It'll
okay.
be like Steve-O calling collect from China.
I'll right? make sure to take it.
Well, let's welcome our Mark Vinoy and go right into that interview. Thank you, Deb. You give me something I can hold on to. I know you think I'm like the other people who saw your name and number on the wall. Danny, I got no number. Welcome back. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. That intro music for our first guest, we went a long way to get to the Jenny Don't Lose That Number. Because, of course, like most things, telephones are controlled by some government authority. And here in Maine, we have the chairman, Mark Vinoy, who is the chairman of the Maine Public Utilities Commission. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the kind invitation to join you.
We looked for other energy intro material, but all we could come up with was Don't Lose the Number.
Yeah, it's a pretty sad commentary on the
yeah,
on my job.
You don't get a lot of pop culture thrown your way, but it's such an important area of business and operations in terms of energy and all that. But before we start talking about policy and what the Maine Public Utilities Commission does, if you could just spend a minute talking a little bit about your background and how you got to this point where you're the chairman of the Maine Public Utilities Commission, like where you grew up, went to school, and then we'll talk about the work that you do.
Certainly. So I grew up in Pennsylvania in a small suburb between Philadelphia and Allentown, Satterton, Pennsylvania. From there through high school, went to a small private high school there and then went on to the Naval Academy. And went through the Naval Academy, studied ocean engineering at the Naval Academy, which is really civil engineering in the water. From there, I went on to the nuclear power community in the Navy and served on a guided missile cruiser.
Yeah, you mentioned that in your background. I was just saying before we went on that I was out in San Diego a couple of weeks ago, and I don't know if your travels ever have taken you there, but at one point there were four aircraft carriers in, you know, they go in and out. That's one of the, I guess, one of the bases for the aircraft fleet. And when you see one up close, it is just so massive and just so incredible as a structure.
Yeah, United States aircraft carrier fleet is really second to none. They are massive ships. They're really cities afloat. I spent time in the Persian Gulf with the Carl Vinson battle group. Oh. And at that time, it was during the no-fly zone period in Iraq. So a second carrier came to the Persian Gulf, which was the Enterprise. And we escorted the Enterprise through the Straits of Hormuz. But to have two aircraft carriers operating in a small area like the Persian Gulf is something to behold.
Yeah, and as a vacation tip for anyone else going to San Diego, if you find yourself with your wife and two children on a rental boat in San Diego Harbor, and a military boat approaches and says, attention recreational craft, stand down, a warship is entering. That's what the vernacular was, a warship. It wasn't an aircraft carrier. It wasn't a Navy vessel. It was a warship is entering. And, you know, even that, even just that small kind of military boat with four or five guys and a machine gun in the front, you immediately go, yes, I'm going to shut down my little engine in my little 14-foot rental boat and move over to the side while the aircraft carrier comes in.
Yeah, in the Navy, we are in... At sea, you call that the law of gross tonnage.
Yeah.
Move aside.
Yeah, nothing can get in the way. So if you don't get out of the way, it would be bad, but it would just be there's just too much inertia. Yeah. So what first brought you here to Maine? What was the job or the vocational thing that brought you from your background in the Navy and growing up in Pennsylvania?
Sure. Well, growing up in Pennsylvania, we're one of those families that vacationed in Maine. So we spent each portion of the first part of the summer in Tenants Harbor area. And I always enjoyed that. My wife, her family is from the Belfast area. And so when I was leaving the Navy, we looked at options either in Maine or in Washington State. And we came to Maine and I worked for Chimbro.
Well, I did the same thing. I was in Atlanta 15 years ago and I ran into a restaurant and I was eating a chicken sandwich and I ran into this beautiful girl. And it was like 10 minutes later, she's like, hey, do you want to get married and move and have babies in Maine? I'm like, yeah. And it was for the love of a woman. That's how I ended up in Maine. Feels like almost everyone I talk to.
It's a good reason.
That should be a whole Chamber of Commerce economic development platform. Find love and return to Maine. Yeah, same thing. So you started out with Chimbro and civil engineering or
that's
that
right.
type of thing?
I worked for Chimbro, not for a very long period, and then moved to a civil engineering firm in Topsom, Wright Pierce. And I worked for Wright Pierce for, I think, about 12 years.
Interesting. So talk a little bit about Maine public utilities. I think everyone has probably an intuitive sense of public utilities, but why don't you describe a little bit both the organization, how it is set up, and what is covered under the umbrella of public utilities here in Maine?
Well, there are quite a few different things covered by utilities in Maine. So we have the things you always think of, electricity, water, natural gas, telecommunications. But another program or another area of regulation that we have are the Casco Bay ferries, for instance. People don't too often think of the Public Utilities Commission and the Casco Bay ferries. We also have some operational programs like the Emergency Services Communication Bureau. So that's the 911 service in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
We oversee that. We also have the Gas Safety Program, which is a delegated program from the feds. We have the DigSafe Program. So if you're digging, you need to contact DigSafe to make sure there aren't other utilities in the area that you plan to dig in. And we also have a Consumer Assistance and Safety Division, which mans phones and is really our customer contact division. So if people have problems with utility service or complaints, they can work through the Consumer Assistance Division to resolve those.
So talk a little bit about why the commission exists and what the extent of your authority is, whether, you know, CMP is a large provider of electricity, and then there's various gas providers and telephone. But is it more of a legislative body where you're setting rates and setting policy, but you do not have direct oversight of the different utilities, whether it's Casco Bay, or is it more actively involved in the actual utility operations themselves?
Well, we are unique in that we're what you would call a quasi-judicial body. So there are three commissioners, and we basically act as judges in cases. We're independent of the legislature, and we're independent of the governor's office of the executive branch. So they are the policy setters, and when they set policy, they enact statute, they enact laws. Well, that statute is what guides us. So we have a law book, Title 35A, and Title 35A really lays out in the beginning the reason we exist. And the reason we exist is to ensure safe, reasonable, and adequate service, utility service, at rates that are just and reasonable to both customers and to the utility. Because the business that the utilities are in are capital-intensive businesses. Mm-hmm. So when they invest money, they need to receive a reasonable return on that money that they invest. At the same time, we have to look at them and make sure that they're not over-investing. They're not gold-plating their systems. They're delivering that safe and reliable service at just and reasonable rates.
Talk a little bit about, we have Mark Vinoy here. He is the chairman of the Maine Public Utilities Commission. Where I understand, I think, some of the mandate that you just described, but where the policy was set originally in terms of federal government oversight and then state that recognized that public utilities were such a critical part of our infrastructure, both nationally and in a state, that it couldn't be left up to private enterprise. You know, it's like, well, we have gas stations, and there's some, you know, there's various oversight of gas stations and weights and measures and stuff, but they basically, gas stations kind of run on their own, and there's other day-to-day areas of life that the government is either more or less, I don't want to say intrusive, but more or less engaged in kind of setting the rules and then enforcing the rules. Talk about the history as you understand it for as long as you've been part of the public utilities. Why it was decided, and why it's a good thing for a government authority, an impartial authority like yourself and the Utilities Commission, to make decisions that serve the public interest above and beyond just normal business practices.
Certainly. So as utilities developed, obviously there's a public interest aspect of that utility practice, but there's also a significant barrier to entry for competitors. So as they developed, what you had was single monopoly institutions providing this service. Well, I think most of us would agree that there are efficiencies in competitive markets. Competitive markets drive efficiencies. But when you have such a high barrier to entry to provide your electric service, for instance, would it make any sense for a company to invest in the infrastructure to run two sets of telephone poles down the street?
Right.
So what grew out of that was the need to regulate the monopoly utility. And what the regulator tries to do is impose some of those competitive efficiencies that our regular ordinary markets would impose on businesses and impose them on the monopoly utility so that they do provide that safe and reliable service at rates that are just and reasonable.
Was the phone breakup an FCC thing or a utilities thing 30, 40 years ago? It used to be Baby Bell or Mother Bell, and I don't remember the year. I just remember kind of a shift in the market where all of a sudden there was a ruling that said there needed to be more competition, which is a little bit the opposite of the consolidation where the government said it's great to have the infrastructure, but not when it doesn't provide price advantages for consumers, and the big advantage often is choice. Right.
Right. So I think that's a great example, the telecommunications market, of, you know, the principle that we would prefer to have competition, and that we try to set regulation in a way that encourages competition. So what you saw in the breakup there was a decision at the federal level, at the FCC level, to move those aspects of the business that could be competitive and open them up to competition, which is exactly what happened. Now, the way that that has played out is interesting because you have currently we're kind of on the tail end of that competition. So competition was introduced. You had a lot of competitive pressures on the providers that were there. I think you've seen tremendous growth in the kind of options that people have for their telecommunications. But then the question becomes the framework of the old idea of universal service. How do you still provide universal service in a competitive market? Because the competitive market targets those areas where the most money is, where it's easiest to provide service. So in urban areas or where there are dense populations, right, you have a lot of options. You probably don't have those options in rural areas. And now the internal subsidy of the company, you know, the telecommunication provider was providing service in the city. He was using some of his profits in the city to internally subsidize some of those lower paying areas in the rural areas. Now you're seeing stresses on that system from the competitive markets that have taken place. It's not a statement on my part against the competitive markets. Sure. It's just simply an acknowledgement that there are stresses in the system.
You also have public policy issues like 911 and public safety, which kind of intersect that. And, you know, but the funny thing about telecommunications, particularly I think in the cellular service market, is it went through a period of breakup and open competition. And now it feels like it's going through contraction where everyone is reconsolidating because of efficiency. So the market, you know, the government force was we're forcing all these opportunities, and different cell companies bought satellite space and they developed their own towers, and Verizon did this and AT&T Wireless did this, and there's been a bunch that have come and gone, and Nextel and Sprint have merged. And now it feels like there are natural forces that are creating, everyone is being acquired, and the market is forcing it back into almost a monopoly or almost of a very closed system. How does the government, whether in public utilities in a state or federally, recalibrate that to go back to what the intent was?
Yeah, so we don't, at the state level, we don't have regulatory authority over the wireless providers. That's an FCC function. But I think they are watching that market very closely, and they probably would not allow, you know, there has to be a public interest in mergers. And so I would guess that further mergers are going to be under a close scrutiny by the FCC because they want to encourage competition in that framework.
Well, let's talk about Maine. We got Mark Vinoy here. He's chairman of Maine Public Utilities Commission. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O and News Talk WLOB 1310. Maine is a fascinating place. I love being in Maine. I travel quite a bit, as I mentioned to you before. I'm heading to China. When this airs tomorrow, I'll be on a flight that day. We have about 35,812 square miles, about 488 municipalities, and 1,308,000 people. But we have so much space. A lot of people talk about, you know, the economic barriers here in Maine, and we have a weak economic engine, and it's northern Maine versus southern, and it's all that. I look at it as physics. And unfortunately, I never took physics, because math kicked my butt, and after about 5 years trying to figure out long division, but it intuitively feels like we have a time-space issue in Maine, and we're in an economy that favors density and efficiency, and as a state, we have massive inefficiency because of so much space and so few people, and for about 1.3 million people, the state has an infrastructure that, by my calculations, could accommodate 7 or 8 million people in terms of highways and bridges and water treatment and basic core functions. But we're so underpowered relative to the economy that it puts more burden on people and businesses. And energy is certainly at the height of that list because it's one of the first states that was populated. We have old structures, we have old technologies, we have the highest dependency on oil. What does Maine need to do specifically in the energy market and specifically in maybe heating to evolve quickly? Because the economy is evolving, business is evolving quickly, and it feels a little bit like here in Maine, we're a little bit slow to evolve because there's a parochial DNA to people here. Like, no, I don't want to look at change. I'm just kind of, which is great if we weren't getting our butt kicked in national economy competitions for business and jobs and global. What do you think from your experience just on the Utilities Commission that Maine needs to do to be more efficient, to be competitive?
Well, it's
if you can come up with the answer, this will be news. This will be
that would certainly be news if I had a silver bullet for that. You know, when you look at the electricity market, we're a restructured state, so we operate in a New England-wide wholesale electricity market, and that New England-wide market is what sets the price for electricity. Now, there are things that we can do with respect to that New England-wide market that are going to have benefits to Maine. One of them is the case that's before us right now, is the whole question of natural gas infrastructure. I'm not going to go into details of that because I'm serving as a judge on that case, so it wouldn't be appropriate. But
I should also disclose that my company has done work in the past with Summit, and I was also, in the spirit of disclosure, chairman of the Yarmouth Town Council up until the last year, for 3 years, and we were active in the interviewing of a number of natural gas providers for the three towns of Cumberland, Falmouth, and Yarmouth. And I was, after looking at the information, a supporter of allowing, not the towns have the control over utility, but in the case of the towns, we have the control of offering municipality contracts for big buildings and schools, which became kind of a catalyst for wanting natural gas in the three towns. So based on my work experience and local municipality experience, I just wanted to kind of get that out there. And as you disclosed, you're a judge in the case, so.
Yeah, so I don't want to go into the details of the case, but I think generally when we look at the energy landscape in Maine, we geographically are 500 miles from one of the most prolific natural gas producing regions in the world. So companies or states that have been able to tie into that natural gas at the prices that are being produced in Marcellus Shale have seen an energy advantage. And I think if you read, if you read anything about the world energy situation, you have Europeans right now who are concerned about the competitive advantage that the United States has on them with respect to energy prices. And that goes back to natural gas. So we're seeing areas of the United States that have that advantage, seeing growth, seeing energy-intensive businesses locating there and so forth and so on. So Maine, I think, has opportunities. Obviously, as you spelled out, its population is spread out over a large area. Its infrastructure needs are great.
Yeah, every mile you put between healthcare, education, and jobs, between a person and those functions, you're adding in efficiency and cost, whether it's physical cost with asphalt, support cost, public safety, or the cost of time, which in a vibrant economy is just as important as intrinsic currency. So all those things, it's like, I issued a plan about 3 years ago. I don't know if you saw that because I didn't recognize your name in the 500 commenters at the Bangor Daily News that wanted to string me up that said, what a crazy idea. I suggested years ago that through policy, we should try to motivate greater consolidation and efficiency here in Maine. Not in a kind of Chairman Mao, we're forcing you to move, but we're going to set policy over a 10 or 15 year period that shifts resources to areas of density and efficiency because those are the things that will attract business. Those are the things that will lower the barrier for jobs. Those are the things that will have better healthcare outcomes. And those are the things that create better educational opportunities when you have more people in an efficient, but we're all spread out poorly.
So for instance, I mean, just the market doing that type of thing, I think an example of that is companies like our local distribution companies for natural gas, like Summit, for instance, mm-hmm. and Maine Natural Gas and Bangor Gas, Unitil. If you look at where they're expanding to population centers and to anchor customers. They need anchor loads in order to expand their gas distribution network, and then they pick up the customers along the route to that anchor load. Those are populated areas. So you have as the infrastructure grows, it's going to those areas. That then becomes, I think, a catalyst for people who are moving into the area. Well, if I live in that area, I can have natural gas. If I live over there, I can't. So you start to see maybe some of what you're talking about just through the competitive process and the reality that population density areas are going to have better services.
So relative to home heating, there's many options that we have here in Maine, and most households, the majority, I believe, are still on oil because that was kind of the heritage and that was the legacy. And natural gas has been available for years, and there has been recently more development and expansion. Where do you see the future in 10 years in terms of the energy platform here in Maine? Do you think natural gas will continue? I don't know if you've been on the other side of our campus, but we just launched the first net positive building in Maine. No boiler, no furnace, no fossil fuels. It's solar powered with heat pumps. This building runs off solar that goes through CMP. What mix of solar, natural gas, wind, and alternative energy do you see? I see a broad mix, but from the utility standpoint, you don't have an interest. You just want efficiency and the best policy for Mainers, right?
Right. So I think you're absolutely right. There's going to be a mix. And I think what we've seen as far as home heating goes, there's been a tremendous change in home heating. Oil heating is really gone down fairly quickly over recent years. And that's due to natural gas. It's also due to heat pumps. Heat pumps are gaining market share. And it's also due to wood pellets. Wood pellets have gained a lot of market share. So, the joke, I think, is when you walk into a lot of rural Maine homes, you're going to see multiple heating sources. You're going to have a wood stove. You might have an oil tank. You may have a heat pump. As you move into areas that have natural gas, you're going to see natural gas appliances. But I think the key that most Mainers like to look at different ways to heat their homes, and due to the climate that we have, having alternatives is always a good thing.
We have Mark Vinoy here. He is the chairman of the Maine Public Utilities Commission. How familiar are you with the Wyman Station in Yarmouth? Are you a little bit familiar with the background?
I'm a little bit familiar, not terribly familiar with it, more or less because we're restructured. So we don't oversee generation sources anymore. They are participating in a competitive market administered by the ISO of New England.
Well, I was going to beat you up over it, and I guess you just took that away, Mark. Now, I live in Yarmouth, and my time in the council spent a lot of time focusing on that. At one point, not that long ago, 20, 30 years ago, the Wyman Station represented, I think, over $200 million of property value for Yarmouth. And as you mentioned with ISO, they literally bid every day on energy production. And I forget the number, it's 12 or 14, whatever area we are in southern Maine in terms of the grid. And because that particular facility is relatively inefficient, they rarely, other than peak times, which is typically really hot days in the summer or once in a while in the winter when there's a blizzard or there's like, so it's this huge infrastructure, but they're only operating at 4-5% or 6%. Every day they wake up and they go, well, does the grid need our power? And they bid, and they get the little note back and the computer says, no power. So they have to, because of my understanding is because of federal regulation, and it also has to do with national security, they have to keep the system alive. So they have to keep the pumps prime. You can't just pull it offline. but they spend most of their energy kind of idling as opposed to producing power. And, you know, for years I've, you know, and because it's owned by a consortium of private companies, there's one core company, then there's investors, and they literally invest in each power plant within the power plant. It feels, I don't want to say it's like a financial Ponzi scheme, but that particular example feels like it goes against public interest because you have this huge infrastructure sitting in a town and it's being run by private enterprise, counter to what I think could be the best interest of the public.
Well, it's an interesting, when you start to look at how the wholesale market works, the independent system of operator New England runs it, as you said, and there are multiple energy markets there. So you have the daily energy market where they put in a bid for the next day in order to run and generate electricity. There's also what's called a capacity supply market, and that's a three-year market where they put in a bid and they get paid on a monthly basis based on how many megawatts they are. And if they win that bid, then they have what's called a capacity supply obligation, which means they have to bid into the daily market and they have to be ready to run if the grid operator needs them. So that's the situation that Wyman finds themselves in. They're around because of what our peak loads are during the summer or during those times during the winter where natural gas pipelines are constrained and generators in New England are unable to get the gas that they need, then they may turn to alternatives like Wyman. So what's happening, though, in New England is that plants like Wyman are under more and more pressure from the competitive forces in the market. So there will come a time where the old oil plants, the old coal plants, and so forth are no longer able to function because the competitive pressures are such that they're too expensive.
And plants like Wyman, is it sludge number three, or there's a name of but it uses an oil product that's very heavy and it looks like tar sludge and it comes in on a big boat and then it's pumped underneath and it's heated. And, you know, I think, I forget which government agency or EPA or DEP or some letter formation 10, 20 years ago required all of these oil burning facilities to install scrubbing equipment and clean air equipment, which has helped. My understanding before I moved here was the air coming out of Wyman was just horrible and it really affected the whole region. But the government, I think, appropriately stepped in and said, you have to spend X number of millions of dollars to put in a filtering system so this dirty oil, which is being burned, at least turns into solid form and we truck it away as opposed to going into the atmosphere. But beyond that, there's nothing you can do. I thought I'd take my plea right to the chairman, but you can't.
We actually don't regulate the generators in that aspect anymore. But certainly there have been changes in EPA requirements, clean air rules, and so forth that have cleaned up some of those situations.
Let's talk about nuclear for a second.
Sure.
You mentioned during your naval career that you were stationed on a ship that was nuclear. And as we mentioned in San Diego, the last non-nuclear aircraft carrier was the USS JFK. Now the entire aircraft carrier fleet are, I believe, nuclear. Submarines are nuclear. But both nationally in Maine and New England, there's become kind of this political issue and an environmental issue on the safety and the viability of nuclear energy. Do you have either a personal view based on your experience serving on a ship where you went to bed every night a few feet from a nuclear reactor to thoughts about viability in the future relative to nuclear power? And I don't know what the stat is, but it feels like it's been decades since a new nuclear plant has gone online in America. And nobody wants to repeat what happened in Japan, which was a combination of engineering, environmental things. But what's your thought on nuclear as a potential viable energy source with new technology that's been developed in the last few decades?
Yeah, sure. I was trained in the Navy's nuclear program, and I actually was licensed as a nuclear engineer in the Navy. So I ran the nuclear power plant on the ship. I have great confidence in the Navy's safety record in the nuclear power industry. I think it is, it's actually kind of an interesting study when you look at the Navy, the way the Navy nuclear power program has worked in designing plants rather than customizing them. They design a single plant, they install it in a ship class. They run that from naval reactors, have an oversight that's similar to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. But what they do is they share information across that fleet. So you're always looking at situations that might develop on a ship where you're multiple stages away from any issue, and you're sharing that kind of information. You have standard operating procedures. You have a lot of things that help to ensure the safety of the operation. Now you transition that to the commercial nuclear world today. A lot of the commercial nuclear plants that are in existence have a lot of customization rather than a standard design.
Something breaks, Freddie, go out to Lowe's, go to Home Depot, maybe a little deeper than that.
I think it's a lot deeper than that.
But there's a little bit of, but there's, not jerry-rigging, but there's a little bit of modification kind of on the fly. And
I wouldn't say on the fly or jerry-rigging. I would just say that there's a lot of customization in the plants. So when that plant was customized to get its NRC original operating license, there are efficiencies lost because you can't share necessarily the same operating experience from that plant to another plant because they're somewhat different. The Navy avoids that kind of issue. I think that improves safety.
Has the Navy ever had a large-scale nuclear issue? I don't recall ever. You know, I'm sure there's somewhere buzzers have gone off and bells have gone off, but has there been a significant catastrophic event on Navy nuclear?
There's not been any catastrophic event on Navy nuclear. There have been, you know, some submarines like the Thresher incident, and there were some others, I believe. And I'm not sure what the root cause of that was, whether it was subsafe systems, you know, pressure integrity, hull integrity right. type issues, or whether I don't think they were nuclear. I think they were subsafe issues. Now, what's interesting, when you look at the Navy nuclear fleet, people don't think about it, but the Navy has nuclear reactors sitting very close to, say, Norfolk. Or in our case,
I thought about it 3 weeks ago in San Diego. I was in a hotel room in San Diego Bay, and I was joking with my kids. I go, "Geez, how close do you think you've ever been to a nuclear reactor?" And my 14-year-old son says, "Oh, we've never been near." And I go, "Well, you're about 100 yards away from a nuclear reactor right now."
And it's because of the safety record of the Navy that I think the public doesn't really.
But Navy is so disciplined. I mean, that's its purpose. It's the way it's built in terms of systems, and you show up at a time, and you run safety. And I know that all nuclear plants are under federal control or NRC, and I know that they think they're as tight, but it doesn't feel like they're ever quite as tight as the military, where Billy and Bobby are, you know, playing on their iPhone, something happens, and, you know, reactor number four. And that, I think, is where the concern from the public. I've never heard any concern from the public relative to nuclear being part of Navy. It's kind of accepted. It's almost like forgotten that when you see these giant ships and, you know, an aircraft carrier can have 4,000 or 5,000 people on it, they operate whether it's in Norfolk for the Atlantic base or in San Diego for the Pacific Fleet or Hawaii. These aircraft carriers are interacting with millions of people in close proximity every day, and nobody's protesting. But the idea of nuclear being land-based, which intuitively would be safer because you don't have the military issue, the wartime issue. You don't have the weather. You don't have waves. You don't have all these variables. Why is it, do you think, that there's such resistance now for America to revisit nuclear? And from your experience, both as a nuclear engineer and now working in the energy era, do you think that's something that we should look at?
Well, I think the nuclear industry has it has been looking hard at how they might move forward. And one area where they are moving forward, where a plant's being built, is in Georgia. Another place is in South Carolina. So there are new nuclear plants being built. I think the industry is looking at that process and seeing if they can bring those on in the time frames that they have projected and in the budgets that they've projected. So I think that's an open question to other utilities out there, whether they would proceed down the nuclear path. The other piece that is interesting as the nuclear industry looks forward is the Clean Power Plan, because the EPA's new Clean Power Plan is looking at the regulation of carbon dioxide. Well, if you set goals for areas to achieve carbon dioxide goals, one of the key ways for areas to get there is through nuclear power. So I think nuclear power, especially in New England, is going to play a key role. The existing plants are going to play a key role in our ability to meet the goals that have been delineated in the Clean Power Plan for carbon dioxide emissions.
What plants do we have in New England that are nuclear that are still here?
We have obviously Seabrook, which is nearby here. Mm-hmm. There are also some plants in Connecticut and Massachusetts. A recent plant shutdown was Vermont Yankee a year ago. So on any given day, nuclear power provides probably 25% to 30% of the electricity on the grid in New England.
What about efficiency on the grid itself? Because from my kind of working with Wyman relative to local government in Yarmouth, one of the things I learned, which I had just kind of taken for granted, that when you have power generation, whether it's nuclear, whether it's oil-based, every mile you send that electricity, the power diminishes or just gets reduced over space, you know. And so the quality of the lines, how they're insulated. And so if you're taking power and you're trying to, you know, ship it over lines 50 miles, you may lose half the power depending on the integrity of the lines and the insulation and all that. Everyone talks about in America and here in Maine, I think it's a real issue. We haven't invested in all kinds of infrastructure, bridges, highways, water treatment, because we're in a paralyzed political situation. And over the last 8 years with the economy tanking, everything has been deferred. Relative to utility infrastructure, including electricity, which is a big part of what you all kind of are connected to, do you have any concerns about our infrastructure here in Maine relative to public utilities?
Well, we'll start with the electrical example you gave. Obviously, there are advantages to local distributed sources of power because you don't have those line losses that you referred to. I think the line losses are probably more down in the 6, 7, 8% range. So what you're trying to trade off in distributed generation is the efficiencies of scale, which is a large central generating plant that then distributes its power over wires, versus distributing that generation on either rooftop solar, or you may have combined heat power systems coming off of natural gas, other ways of doing it, maybe a small hydro plant that are serving local load pockets. So there's always this engineering equation, optimization question, right, between centrally produced power and distributed generation. And I think a lot of situations are unique. You need to look at what the infrastructure is. Is it, you know, to go with another central plant, are you going to have to upgrade transmission wires to accommodate? And then what's the cost of that transmission upgrade? Could that be offset by doing a distributed generation instead? So one interesting statute that came about was a requirement. Anytime we look at transmission upgrades, per statute, we have to look at non-transmission alternatives first.
What would an example about non-transmission alternatives be?
So you may be able to, a good example actually is the Booth Bay pilot that's going on. You may be able to defer a transmission upgrade by looking at a specific line, doing efficiency upgrades of businesses along that line, doing some portion of standby generation. Maybe there's a hospital there that already has an emergency generator, and the only time that the line fails is during peak load at such and such. Well, maybe that emergency generator could be running instead. And then you avoid the millions of dollars required for that transmission upgrade. Or maybe you can put distributed solar along some of these on some of these rooftops. Then you get into questions of intermittency and is it going to be there when you really need it? All the, you know, the complexity gets pretty significant, but I think in theory there are some opportunities there, and we're doing that right now through a pilot in Booth Bay that's looking at that.
What type of oversight does the PUC do relative to wind and relative to solar? And then also offshore. There's a lot of research being done in terms of offshore wind generation and wave generation. There's technology that seems like it may be promising because we have the ocean, we have waves, that creates power and energy itself. And is that under the PUC oversight? Or once energy is produced and it goes somewhere, is that the mechanism that falls under the umbrella?
Well, it depends how it's set up. Most of the, you know, we have an Ocean Energy Act that was a statute that the PUC administers that provides above market prices to qualifying resources. So we have a tidal project down east that qualified under that program, and we have a long-term contract with them for that demonstration project. There's also an outstanding term sheet that was approved for an offshore wind project, but it was contingent on getting Department of Energy funding, and that Department of Energy funding never came through. So that's kind of that's sitting there right now, but it may be come back before us. I think with a lot of those technologies, I've said this before, but it's as an ocean engineer, I'm very much interested in them. I spent a lot of time in wave tanks. I spent a lot of time looking at some of those things, and so often it's not the technological viability of it. The technology is there. It's getting the price down to where it can be competitive with other sources. So a lot of that comes down to pricing. And maybe there can be technology breakthroughs that drive those prices down to grid-scale competitive prices.
Do you think Maine and New England is particularly open to innovation in new technology and energy? And I travel quite a bit, and there are other places in other countries where, you know, Germany comes to mind, where I think over half their power now is solar generated, where other countries just make a commitment, or maybe it's out of necessity. Maybe they don't have access to fossil fuels as readily available. They aren't close to oil fields, and so they've had to invest in systems. But here in Maine, it just feels like we're dragging our feet a little bit relative to energy, and there's a lot of not in my backyard, whether it's having transmission lines or whether it's new plants or something else. Or do you think that it's just the nature of human nature, whether it's in Maine or whether it's in New Mexico or whether it's in Amsterdam? But it feels like in Maine, you know, Deb, back me up here. And Deb, you need to quiet down in there.
Yes.
You're not getting the big bucks just to sit there.
I know.
You know. I saw this week's payroll. So you're not. But what kind of power do you have? How do you heat your house?
I have oil right now still, unfortunately. But I'm looking at solar for the future. And if natural gas was to come down my way, I would get on it right away.
Yeah.
I would.
I mean, I went through a whole. And again, I disclosed that we've done work with Summit, and I think they're a great company. But before even that relationship, I looked at it, and I think that it's still a bridge fuel. I think it burns cleaner than oil. And I think the pricing kind of flipped around in the last year or so because of what's happened with oil. Mm-hmm. But I think long-term, natural gas is just, for me, it was a better play.
It's a good solution.
But there are still some people in Maine that are like, oh, I don't want to do that. I don't want, you know, it could blow up. Or it's this fear and maybe some resistance that is just
lack of education, I think. But also I think the cost to switch over is scary to some. We're not exactly a rich state.
Yeah. You know? Well, there is some investment depending on if you're going from propane. It's a smaller conversion because you kind of just change, you know, the nozzle or something because you're burning gas. But, mm-hmm. yeah, if it's oil, I just you know, and then a big issue in our state, which people, which is kind of the low-hanging fruit, is insulation. We're one of the most poorly insulated states. And it's like you can knock on somebody's door and said, hey, hello, have you read the report? If you spend $1,000 over a few years, you can save $5,000 in energy costs. And people are like, nah, I don't believe that, Balaki. And I don't know what it is. I just, it feels like we have so much opportunity here in this state. But energy and utilities and the connectivity of all that stuff are critical. But if people won't change, if the human component is being obstinate, how can we fix that, Mark? We've got the chairman of the Maine Public Utilities Commission here, and we've got another 2 minutes. How can we fix that to get Maine more efficient, better energy, more connectivity, more density and efficiency, better education, healthcare, all of it? Let's just, what can we do to fix it?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm more of a markets kind of guy. So
the markets are slow.
Yeah. So the markets slow. So you look at you know, there are obviously state programs for efficiency, and Efficiency Maine is out there doing a lot of good work, offering opportunities for people to do insulation.
Have you seen our LED lights? Have you seen we've done it? Have you seen our fountains? We've got radiant heat. We're doing it.
But part of the reason you're doing it is because it makes sense economically. And I think that is what ultimately drives the changes, is when people see that they make economic sense, they go out and they do it themselves. So obviously there can be state programs that maybe reduce the payback from 6 years to 4 years or 6 years to 3 years, so that people can adopt those kind of changes. But when you look through, you know, the history of energy is a very slow changing adoption.
Talking about going all the way back to dinosaurs.
Go back to burning wood.
Right.
You know, we burned wood for many years, and then slowly there was a transition to oil, and then burned oil for many years, and slowly there was a transition to natural gas.
Right.
You look through the history of that, and adoption is slow. I think that's just the nature of how markets change and how new products, new technologies change the opportunities in front of somebody. And when the economics are there, people make the move.
Well, I want to thank you for coming in. I think whether it's we talked about energy, we spent a lot of time talking about energy, but all the different areas of the public utilities I think are critical for day-to-day life, both for people, you know, residents and for businesses. And thanks for your service and on the commission. I'd love to have you come back sometime.
I appreciate it. I enjoy my morning with you.
Yeah. And if people want more information to learn about the Public Utilities Commission, if you go to maine.gov/MPUC, you can find the work that they're doing. And if you want to call up Mark and ask him a question, he didn't offer this suggestion, but I'm saying he's a friendly guy. He's very knowledgeable. And I'd love to have you come back sometime soon.
Certainly. Thank you.
You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. I'll be in China next week, but we'll be back live from China. Thank you for listening.